Sometimes I wonder just what I'm fighting for. I win some battles, but I always lose the war. I keep right on stumbling in this no man's land out there. But I know, yes, I know, that there must be a better world somewhere. Flying high, some joker clips my wings just 'cause he gets his kicks. And he's doing those kind of things. Keep on falling into space, even hanging in midair. But I know, yes, I know, that there must be a better world somewhere.
Malcolm John Rebenack, also known as Mac Rebenack, or Dr. John Creo, or Dr. John the Night Tripper, or just played Dr. John from New Orleans with There Must Be a Better World Somewhere. It's from his 1995 album, Afterglow, and he's still going strong at 77. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And, oh, Lord, you know, we can all use a little break from the kind of news that every minute of the day something else is unfolding. And you really can't help but think, as Dr. John just said, there must be a better world somewhere. We can't keep this up. Well, but we still have to, because that's what's called for. That's called life. A week into a strike by 50,000 teachers in Arizona over long overdue salary increases and funding for basics like books and school supplies, and one doesn't get the sense that this constitutes a state of emergency, certainly not in this administration. Similarly, in Colorado, some 10,000 teachers walked off their jobs demanding pay hikes, facility upgrades, and new textbooks for students. The state governments of Arizona and Colorado, are maintaining they simply don't have the money. Shouldn't this be where the Trump administration that wants to make America great again, shouldn't this be a shining hour for them? No, it's not. Just yesterday, there was a request to meet with the teachers by Betsy DeVos, who is the Secretary of Education. Nothing has been resolved. But in the meantime, let's talk about what we are talking about here. We're talking about a 1.4 million students out of class. We're talking about the main reason being that their teachers have been, for years now, underpaid. We're talking about the fact that they don't have things that they need to study with, like textbooks. This is the kind of stuff that your president, Donald Trump, would quickly assign to third world countries was right here. I can't imagine that the state of affairs, and this isn't the first time, as you know, we've talked about teachers walking off the job, having to do that because they're tired of putting out their own money to buy pencils and textbooks and whatever else that they need to just get some basic things done in the classroom. And it's also the fact that we have this constant refrain, we don't have the money. We don't have the money. This is the cry from the various state governments. We don't have the money. So while we would like to pay teachers a living wage, and while we would like our students to be educated, we just have to ask the teachers and the students to bear with us a little while longer, a couple more years maybe, and perhaps by the time they graduate, they'll get textbooks and they'll get what they need to proceed with an education. This is outrageous. We have about 1.4 million students. And this is just two states, Colorado and Arizona, who are not in school. They simply don't have the basics. What a disgrace this is. And yet we see all the different ways in which this administration is just absolutely wasting money. People are flying first class everywhere. They're buying $31,000 or $34,000 desks and setting themselves up with private phone booths in their offices, costing upwards of $40,000. And living very nicely on the people's dime. And yet, there are no school books for the children to use for an education. It tells us that priorities are lopsided. And it should constitute a state of emergency as if adults had to walk off the jobs and stage strikes all over the country over issues of pay and job safety and whatever else. Because it is happening to children, and the teachers dedicated to their task, it's not a big deal. And yet we're heading into the second week of this craziness. And we don't get the sense that this constitutes an emergency. This constitutes a major problem. Because it is Arizona and it's Colorado today, but you know, this thing is... it is the same problem that we see in so many other states. Teachers have been complaining for decades. I know many teachers myself who have had to dig into their own pockets to provide the basics so that they can proceed with what they are there for, which is to provide an education for children. Miss Betsy DeVos, the multi-million dollar member of Donald Trump's cabinet, who is supposedly the Secretary of Education. And you see here a very interesting line. The same lackadaisical attitude existed in the Obama administration, where the Secretary of Education himself needed an education. He had no qualifications for the job. But he did play basketball with Barack Obama, and boom, he's a Secretary of Education. Now, what does that have to do with advancing the quality of education available to America's children? It has nothing to do with it. And here we have a situation where immediately, the minute this situation happened, where teachers are walking out, they feel forced to walk off the job. You can't tell me that this is what a teacher wants to do. They themselves are taking a risk because a vengeful state system will come back at them and fire them for walking off the job. The problem isn't being tended to. It's not being fixed. It's not being addressed. And they have to go to the extreme to get some kind of attention. And mark my word, they will have to pay a price because they're not supposed to do this. This is an act of rebellion as far as administrations are concerned. And the state continues to repeat the same nonsense. We don't have the money. Well, it means that somebody is not doing a very good job of balancing a budget. And somebody believes that the education of children is low on the totem pole. It's not a high priority. And I can't get through my head. What are people thinking? That this is the state of affairs of the nation's schools. And yet people expect so much. They expect children to be properly trained, the new generation coming along with specialized knowledge and ready to pick up the mantle of leadership in their time. No, it won't happen. Unless governments are forced to do what they're supposed to do. There's no reason that a teacher has to feel compelled to walk off a job, which is the only way they make a living, and take a chance by making a bold statement in behalf of the children, in behalf of education. Take a chance because this vengeful system will come back at them and put them out of commission. It is not confined, as you know, to Arizona and Colorado. It is all over the United States, where there is simply no priority given to education. No priority. And it's even worse, you can surmise, in distressed communities, where the going philosophy is, we have no money. So if you have no money, how do you expect to get things done? How do you expect to deliver quality education to children? And how do you expect
that people should, accept it. Every nation, no matter how poor, realizes this is a priority item. And they try to find all kinds of ingenious ways to make sure that the children's education is provided for. I don't understand why we think that this is okay. And I don't understand why the Secretary of Education continues to have a job. I don't understand why the people of the United States think that this will just work itself out. None of this is going to happen. We have to get involved, and we have to absolutely reject the notion that children have to be prepared to sacrifice their future because the adults, the people elected to serve them and their needs, just don't know what they're doing or don't care to place them as a high priority item. And the more, these things happen and people are quiet about it, they figure, well, if it's happening in Arizona, we'll have, we localize the problem so that people in Connecticut or people in Washington, D.C., they don't have to worry about it. They'll see that this is a problem in Arizona. The Arizona folks will take care of that. It's time for us to demand that Betsy DeVos be fired. It's time to support teachers. It's time to place children as a high priority item in budgets. And it's time to get very exercised about any system that does not agree that they are supposed to be high priority items. That's just my feeling. So Mike Pence, your vice president, decided to keep the issue of the wall going. He visited a wall building project in Calexico, California, and used it as a backdrop to tell the media that President Trump will have his wall. Early in the day, about 150 people, most of them from Central American states, seeking asylum in the United States, were turned away at a border crossing processing center in San Diego. We talked about this yesterday. We talked about the fact that suddenly people seeking asylum were told or turned away from these processing centers with the explanation that there is no room. We have no room for asylum seekers in the United States. Well, of course there is room. And of course there's room under international law and even U.S. law. There's an interesting thing going on here in which Trump, the Trump administration, is conflating asylum seekers with so-called illegal immigration. They're not the same. Under international law, people seeking asylum because they are trying to flee countries that they're living in that are racked with corruption and basic terrorism every day. The levels of violence are intolerable. They cannot lead normal lives. And if you were able to catch a little bit of the the coverage of this event, you see most of them are women and children. Donald Trump will have us believe that these are the people who are making things worse for Americans. They're poor, they're rapists, they're criminals. And we must do everything possible to keep them out. When I looked at who's online trying to legally and legitimately file applications for asylum, I don't see rapists. I see very poor people in a desperate situation. I see women, I see children dominating the people trying to do things the right way under the law. International law provides that people seeking asylum, people desperately seeking to be admitted to a country because the countries that they previously were living in, life cannot be lived comfortably in those countries, and it's no fault of their own. When you have this kind of daily terror that is going on, and the response of the world, especially the leading nations of the world, the response is you have just got to stay there. It's unfortunate that you were born there. It's unfortunate that you're living there, but you're going to have to stay there. That's not what international law says. But apparently, you also have to have the right skin color, because to insist that you should be reclassified as an asylum seeker is to say that you wish to take advantage of a privilege that does not accrue to you. This is the same problem that we're having with the North African asylum seekers, driven from their country by internal conditions that simply are inhumane and intolerable. The people that I'm talking about undertook a 6,000 mile plus journey. And they weren't traveling in vans and trucks. They were coming on foot to these centers where they supposedly were to be processed, their applications taken for asylum, and the process would begin where they go through a routine of being further investigated to decide whether they, under the law, qualify for asylum. But the United States does not wish to obey the law. The response to these people leaving countries where these conditions obtain, and make no mistake, these conditions are tied to conditions that have their roots outside of their country. Very often it is the United States itself, where you have not just unemployment, but no hope of employment at a living wage. You have violence of extreme dimension. We had just the other day the story of three students, art students, mistaken for members of a rival gang. They were murdered and then put in vats of acid to totally disintegrate them and make it impossible for anybody to identify them. This is a kind of, this is not theory. This is what is happening every single day in some parts of the world. And in many ways, we are linked to that kind of violence as a country. So the United States is actually breaking the law and manipulating the law to make it appear that these people, this classification of people who are trying to get asylum, according to the law, nobody's breaking the law, they are all going by the book. The response is, and it's a total lie, that these people are actually illegal immigrants. They're not the kind of people we should want in our country. And even if international law says that their applications must be received and considered, the response by the administration is, right up front, we build a wall and keep everybody out. No distinctions between people who are suffering extreme hardship or violence or any of the conditions as enumerated by international law. We don't pay attention to that. On the other hand, we have to the north, our border with Canada, not experiencing any of this. You don't hear about people, Trump wanting to build a wall on the Canadian border. Not at all. Or close off the Windsor Tunnel out of Detroit, out of Michigan, into Canada. You don't hear about these proposals. A different class, a different type of in-migration is going on. It's illegal. These people are not fleeing terror. They're not fleeing violence. They want economic opportunity. And most of them are not of the complexion of the people in the South. You would think that a man whose mother came to this country looking for opportunity comes from a little island near Scotland and happily looking forward to a job as a maid because it was far better than anything she had known in her own country. And I'm talking about Donald Trump's mom. And she stayed here beyond, he gives the explanation that she came on a holiday and just happened to overstay. No, she didn't happen to overstay. That was the plan. To come to the United States and to stay here, get a job, and she was hoping, even as a maid, that would be great. No skills, not able to function at a higher level, but still the humanity was there. She was a person living in abject poverty. And to her, it would have been a great joy, a great accomplishment to land a job as a maid in the United States. Well, what's wrong with that? People have ambitions. Simply. simply because you're born in poverty doesn't mean you have no ambitions at all. And in pursuit of those ambitions, you come up against the question of, how does the law accommodate you? There was no law at that time that said, oh yeah, come on in. We have lots of maid jobs. The thing is, you use your wits and you find your way. But that does not hold for everybody. And the son of a woman like that, you would think, would have a special sensibility about what life is like for many people at that level. At that level of desperation. But again, when you have the mentality of a racist, you can make these distinctions without a problem. You can sleep like a baby, denying people what essentially are now their human rights. And you can commit your country to breaking the law. You don't have to observe international law. You don't have to uphold international law. You just do what you want to do. And his thing is, I'm going to build a wall. It really is about sending a message to the country, United States, and the rest of the world, that what guides the thinking of this administration is pure, unadulterated, throwback racism. And using every opportunity you have to send the message that at every level we are going to reorganize our social structures in this country based on who deserves and who does not deserve privileges and rights. That's what this is all about. If he were as intent on building a Canadian wall, I said, well, generally this guy's into walls. But that's not the case. Walls for some, compassion for others. And they're perfectly okay turning their heads away from what is going on. The Canadian border is bleeding with people going to Canada and coming into the United States. Everybody knows it. You're not building a wall there. You're not interested in building a wall there. But in the South, where people are trying to just flee, just to get some basic things like, you know, a place to live where their children are safe, where they are safe, they could get a little job, perhaps like Trump's mom, get a job as a maid, and you believe you have achieved a great, you know, a great thing. And it is a great thing. But it also is the law that they are not to be denied by this effort of building walls and telling people there's no more room and turning people away from filing an application for asylum. No, you have to obey the law, and we should insist on that. We'll take this little break and come back to our discussion, which we started yesterday. We're looking at what your impressions are. We're not going to get into the details of the case yet. We're just talking about your visceral reaction to the conviction of Bill Cosby, and we will proceed with that right after this break.
If it is, maybe in the hereafter, instead of tears, I've learned all about laughter. Meanwhile, I'm stuck out here. Lord knows it just ain't fair. But I know, yes I know, that there must be a better world somewhere.
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead. Well, we started the issue, the task, I should say, of sharing our views about the conviction last Thursday of well-known entertainer Bill Cosby, who was convicted by a jury of 3 counts of aggravated indecent assault for sexually assaulting a female basketball coach he had mentored in his Philadelphia home in 2004. The 80-year-old comedian faces up to 10 years in prison on each count when he is sentenced in June. It was, of course, a very high-profile case, and with a lot of contributing factors, which you will tell us what you think about that. And it was also a sad moment to see a man of his stature and of his age come to such an undignified end. Make no mistake about it. This is the end of his life as he has come to know it. So we started talking, but we didn't get through the long line. And I believe in giving people the space to express themselves about what was your take, the big picture take. Not the fine details, but, you know, the big picture. How did you interpret what had happened? And as I asked the question, did you think that he got a fair trial or not? Was that a fair trial? And we can call 888-874-4888. And we pick up the conversation for where we left off. We're not in this exercise seeking to dissect the case. That will come. But we're looking for what your visceral reaction was and what stood out to you as being very significant in this case and troubles you, if it troubles you at all. So, let's start off with Rachel from Brooklyn. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, Utrice and the PRN family. Nice to hear you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and good afternoon to you.
I have a statement and a question. My statement is, I do believe that Bill Cosby is guilty. And I also believe that this trial was racially motivated. Now, my question, when Bill Cosby was first tried, and the jury, and I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, the jury came back as a hung jury, correct?
Yes. In the first trial, it was declared a mistrial, yes.
Okay. My question is, now he's being tried again for the same thing. Isn't that considered double jeopardy?
No. Double jeopardy would be if he were convicted.
Okay.
The idea is that in a double jeopardy situation, you're being tried, there may be legal experts out there who could correct me on this.
Okay.
He was not convicted in the first trial.
Okay. Got you. Okay. Okay. Well, that was basically my statement, my question. But thank you for clarifying that with me. But I do agree with a lot of what the callers were saying yesterday.
Oh, okay. But you do believe he was guilty?
Yes, because he admitted at one point that he admitted in the last trial that he was drugging, that he did use drugs on these women. So he even admitted that himself.
Yes. However, did he admit that with respect to a particular woman?
Okay, I got you. Okay. Okay.
I mean, this is what she said he did to her, but
okay.
He did not admit to, you know,
several women. Okay.
You know, he did make the statement, yes, in that time drugs were part of the in crowd at the scene. But did he admit to giving her drugs?
Got you. Well, again, as I said before, I do believe it was racially motivated, and I'm waiting to see if they're going to come after Harvey Weinstein with the same venom. And that's all
I'll
I have to say.
Explain that a bit. Why do you think it is racially motivated?
Just the fact that who he is and his status. And I believe, like a gentleman said yesterday, he referenced like a payback. He referenced something in reference to O.J. Simpson and Bill Cosby, and maybe this is like a little payback, so to speak. I don't know if I'm expressing myself, you know,
you're doing
correctly,
fine.
But
I just needed to know from your perspective what your explanation was, what your understanding was, and what your opinion was.
And
well, thank
I,
you
and
so
I
much
believe,
for
thank
calling
you.
In
thank you, Patrice.
And getting us
Have
started
a great day.
Today. Thank you. Michael from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Utrice. It's a pleasure to speak with you and the PRN audience.
Thank you. Same here.
I think Mr. Cosby is not too smart. I think the power went to his head that he felt that he had, and he made a lot of mistakes. First of all, he broke rule number one. I have a rule number one for life. Never make a woman angry. Don't do it. He broke that rule. He broke rule number two. Don't bypass the rules of engagement by giving somebody a drug, for example. Rule number three, don't pursue the impossible. I think that Mrs. Constance, I don't know how to pronounce her name,
Constand. Yes.
I think she was gay to begin with. And so he's pursuing the impossible. And don't admit what you later have to deny, which is that you give women drugs and then you have to deny it. So I think he's very contradictory kind of figure. Also a very avuncular kind of character, who gives out advice. Well, that's the should be. And the what is what he actually is a predator. So there's so much contradiction there. And I think the jury was able to see through all that and, you know, make him own up to what actually was. Now, as far as the racial part of it, the article I read today, the jurors spoke, they didn't come into their consideration. But racial bias is kind of unconscious, so we can't really say that for sure.
Well, you know, as we consider this case more deeply, you also have to consider the fact that the environment of the case, and this relates specifically to jurors, when you serve on a jury, essentially, whether overtly or covertly, you are under the jurisdiction
of the court officers, of the court system, of the prosecutors, of the judge. It takes an extraordinary juror to get through all of that and to set all of that aside and just look strictly at the case. This is a major influencing factor in how juries make decisions. I mean, you in the court, you're under supervision of the court. You leave the court to go for lunch, you're under supervision of the court officers. So they had a lot of time, they spent a lot of time in the jurisdiction of the court without even knowing it. And I think there ought to be studies about the impact of this system where jurors, even when they are sequestered, they are under the influence and they're in the environment of the system itself. So you can't just say that, you know, they made an unusual decision or they were right to make a decision or wrong to make a decision. The question is, to what degree was the environment responsible for their decision?
Right. I mean, there's an article today that I read that suggested when they interviewed, they did interview jurors. And, you know, according to what the jurors are saying is that they weren't really influenced, they felt, by race or by the Me Too movement, and that they felt that the woman was believable, and that really that wasn't even what was determinative in their decision, but rather what he himself said about drugging women that was in the court records. They felt that he hung himself with his admissions, you know, to doing.
Well, this is the issue. I think there's more than enough room to question the circumstances. What was the relationship between Constant and Bill Cosby? I don't understand what that relationship was, and I don't think it was explored fully. Because she would have had to admit complicity in that relationship. And they didn't want that part to be known.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, why would a logical woman go to somebody's private home even though she strongly suspects, because she'd had some prior experience with him before, that it could happen again?
Yes, but it's apparently she's gay, so that also has can have an impact that she might not have had that on her mind at all.
There are gay men who go both ways.
Yes.
Just because she's gay doesn't mean that she is, you know, not at all entertaining other possibilities.
No, she could be bisexual or she could be gay. You know, so we don't know, Utrice. We don't know
exactly
what part that played.
We don't
but
know.
But it could have had an impact.
Questions.
Also, it could have really peed her off, you know, more so because it was an attack, if you will, on a counter-sexual basis. I mean, we don't know that those factors.
I think we have to ask the questions about the environments, the various environments of this case, and how they impacted on the jury's decision. So we'll see as we go. Right now, we're just getting from everybody what their big picture sense was. So yours is that it is quite possible that she might have participated willingly, or that she herself was going through some kind of a personal turmoil about a relationship that was very, very complicated and too much to handle. I don't know how to put it.
And I also felt like the other callers before that, you know, the settlement thing is kind of disturbing, that a woman takes over $3 million from this man and then goes after him. You know, give back the money then.
Well, that's an interesting observation, and it's a very legitimate question. You take money, and you
not a little money, a lot of money.
Right. Money is offered. Money is demanded. Money is offered. You take it, but you don't observe the conditions all the way through. All right. Thanks a lot, Michael, for your call today. Dean from Staten Island, what are you thinking?
Hello. How are you?
Okay. How are you, Dean?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm glad and relieved that this sick serial rapist has been found guilty. And I'm sorry that he's an old man, but what he did was so horrible to so many women. I just think he's going to have to prepare himself. And it's for the betterment of society that he goes away for so many years. And I think he's also a hypocrite for talking in with so many conservative ideas, and that he's so clean and pious. And when he was raping women for who knows how long, who knows how many. So many women have come forward. It's just disturbing.
Yes, I would agree with you in the sense that that's the report that we have. Now, you just said that he's been doing this for a long time, how many women and so forth. What evidence, what specifically are you referring to as evidence that backs up that contention?
Well, he was found guilty.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean anything. A lot of people are found guilty who are not.
Well, in our society, if you're found guilty, if many women have accused you of being a rapist, if he paid out money to someone, if he said he gave pills and drugs to women, I don't see why you're sticking up for him in such a strong way.
I'm not sticking up, and don't go there, because you'd be heading in the wrong direction. I'm not sticking up for anybody. I'm asking because we assumedly have evolved to appreciate the complexities of the law. Simply because somebody does something doesn't mean the person is guilty. For example, including this the matter of paying people. He is a well-known individual. It is, why aren't you considering the possibility he might have been extorted? Why aren't you considering the possibility that payments were made to avoid a public, some public scene in which he would be hurt in terms of his career? These things happen. People make a choice. It's not always the right choice, but sometimes the idea is to avoid a very untenable situation in the short term for a long-term peace of mind. And they do things that will then later on be interpreted as a signal of guilt. Well, why did you pay the person? I mean, it's a legitimate question. I'm not saying that your question is not legitimate. I'm just saying hold on to the idea just the same that there might be many other reasons why people come to terms and settle. You know, when we've talked about these police brutality cases in which families have settled, according to the terms of settlement, they cannot hold a cop who kills their son responsible for anything publicly. They can't do it, even though that would be the fact. They agree in the settlement that this didn't happen. No police officer was responsible. The city, as an employer of the errant cop, is not responsible. These are things they actually agree to, which are totally contradictory to the facts. But that's what the settlement process required. You see what I'm saying? So we have to appreciate the nuances of the law, where settlements might have been made, but what was the reason behind the settlement? What was the thinking behind the settlement? And one of the terms of settlements, including in the Cosby case, is that the person agreeing to settle also agrees to set this whole thing aside. It never happened. Isn't that silly? Isn't that a weird kind of logic? But it is true. So we can't automatically assume that because he came to terms with some people by a settlement, that those instances were truly instances in which money was paid to avoid trial on prospective charges that he sexually assaulted these people. It is that the women in question agreed to set it aside and take the money, if that was the case. It's a complicated thing, but we always have to keep that in mind. And don't jump to conclusions, because he paid money to a lot of people. It is quite possible that some of these payments could well be interpreted as a successful kind of extortion, where people were threatening, even though nothing happened to them, but they threatened to go public with a story and make it appear that, yes, they were victims. And the decision was made, look, let's just, what do you want? I want X amount of dollars. Okay, here's your X amount of dollars. Sign this piece of paper saying, with this payment, you're forgetting everything. And get out of my life. That is also a possibility. Well, that brings us to the end of the program. I am so fascinated by how we are interpreting. This is like Rashomon, the Japanese movie, all these different interpretations of the same event. Stay tuned. Keep it right here on PRN, and you'll see each other tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening and participating today. Bye-bye.
But I always lose the war. Keep right on stumbling in this no man's land out there. But I know, yes I know, that there must be a better world somewhere.